Hello, Blogging Heads Nation. I'm Daniel Dresner. I'm a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, and I also write the Spoiler Alerts blog for The Washington Post.
And I'm Heather Herbert from Human Rights First, and this is me, jet lagged.
So, Heather, you have just come back from a trip to Turkey, I believe, which we will talk about a little bit later. But I thought I would fill you in about sort of things that have happened in the Beltway while you were gone. One of which is you might not be aware that Hillary Clinton has a memoir out.
No.
I know. It's true. And it's called Hard Choices. And it's apparently about her time as Secretary of State. And as you can imagine, the entire conversation about this book has only been about her foreign policy record. There's been no other – oh, wait, there was one issue that's come up. So there's been
wait, don't tell me there's – I missed a week of really scintillating, in-depth discussion of different ways to promote women's empowerment around the book. And there was a really powerful argument about the question of whether the U.S. has a right to be engaged in that conversation at all.
You know what?
No.
You are so good. I can't believe that's exactly what happened. And then Ann Coulter went on Fox News and admitted error on everything and said that, you know, the scales had fallen from her eyes and she now realized that this message of empowerment was going to be key. And she volunteered to become a DAS on this very issue.
Okay. Now, Dresner, I think I'm hallucinating from sleeping pills.
No. So the interesting thing that's come out from the sort of book promotion business is she's made repeated statements about this question of money. And about where, how does she sort of views herself? You know, it started with Diane Sawyer, where I think you were in town then, where she talked about how they were sort of dead broke when they left the White House, which was technically true, but yet a little bit sort of sounded off key. And then most recently in an interview with The Guardian last Sunday, she talked about, you know, how, well, no one begrudges, you know, Bill Clinton and Mai's income because we pay ordinary income taxes. Which sort of neglects the fact that their net worth is really, really large. So I wrote a blog post about this, which I'm intrigued about the reaction to, which is that I kind of took David Brooks's Bobos in Paradise and applied the concept he developed there called status income disequilibrium to explain what's going on with Hillary Clinton, which is status income disequilibrium is something that both you and I know as foreign policy wonks, which is there's a tendency to occasionally live sort of first-class lifestyles by day when you get to go to really nice confabs or what have you, and then middle-class lifestyles at night. Now, Hillary Clinton is far from middle-class, but I do think in this sort of age of Piketty, in a world where you're only consorting, where you're primarily consorting with the top 0.01%, feeling like you're in the 1% nevertheless still feels poor. And so I do wonder if one of the things that's gnawing at Hillary is the fact that she feels she has justifiably really worked incredibly hard to get where she is, and yet she doesn't have more money.
I read it quite differently from that.
Okay.
Actually, I think you're right, and I remember feeling this when I was in the Clinton White House at the end, and I must say everything in my career subsequently has reinforced this, which is as a wonk, or even worse, as the job of a politician,
right,
because of the way we run our systems, is to hang around with really wealthy people,
exactly,
is to hang around with the 0.01%,
yeah,
and make them like you.
Right.
And in doing that, and frankly, even to the very small amount that I did it as a nonprofit executive, you sort of can't help noticing that they have really nice stuff and they do really fun things. And, you know, when they invite you to their conferences, they're in really nice places. And when they invite you to their vacation homes, they're really lovely. And, you know, maybe they have cars or books or paintings that you read about in magazines. And, you know, one of the reasons I think that the American public, as opposed to, I must say, the media,
yeah,
but the public is generally very tolerant of wealth in our leaders, is that everyone sort of gets this, that, yeah, it'd be really nice to have, you know, a house in the Dominican, on the beach in the Dominican Republic or whatever it is. So I do think a lot of politicians and, frankly, a lot of our peers, you know, in the think tank,
yeah,
world, let's not, and in the academic world, let's, you know, people who live in glass houses and all that.
No. I think part of the reason I think I wrote that is because I because I'm in that same boat, except not even remotely in the 1%, but I agree with you. This is something I know from personal experience.
Right. So, but, you know, Hillary, they grew up, you know, very middle class back when that was a real thing. And so I personally think part of the reason she handles it so awkwardly is that, she knows very well that she's ended up someplace that's not at all where she started out and is not at all where most Americans are. So I actually think the awkwardness with which she has handled it reflects a genuine feeling of awkwardness about it, which I personally think is a good thing, but I grant you, in American politics, awkwardness is seldom a good thing.
Okay, I will push back a little bit on this, so I'll give you one chance to respond and then we can move on, which is to say, if that was true, I mean, in some ways, Bill Clinton grew up in even more, you know, didn't grow up middle class, he grew up lower middle class, I think, or potentially actually poor. And yet Bill Clinton has actually handled this with far greater aplomb, I would argue. Which is to say, he's pretty much acknowledged, we're rich now and we're very grateful that, to this country because we can pay so much in taxes and so on and so forth. So.
But Dan, that's exactly the difference between growing up poor and growing up middle class, frankly. You know, growing up, you know, sort of white Protestant middle class, you get a big dose of guilt about this stuff. Growing up poor, you know, you don't have the luxury of romanticism about it. And so I actually see the difference in responses as being, you know, very predictably linked to the different circumstances in which they grew up.
Okay, for the record, I will not feel, maybe this is because I'm not Protestant, I will not feel guilty at all if I were ever to make the 1%. I just want to make that, get that out there. You know, not going to feel guilty. I'll give some money back, don't get me wrong, but, you know, I can deal with that burden if people want to, you know, somehow elevate me to that level.
Okay, well, just because this is sort of the perfect explanation, I mean, I actually, you know, I make a lot more money than I ever expected to make for doing something I love to do as much as what I love to do.
Right.
And I'm, you know, there's a camera. I shouldn't say I would do this stuff for free because there's a camera. Oh, we are doing this for free. That's right. I do feel a certain amount of sort of white liberal Protestant guilt that I actually get to do something I love doing, and, you know, I'm well into the top 10%, and that's amazing, and it's not necessarily fair. You know, the kids, the teachers who teach my kids, you know, I would pay them more than I would pay me if I were designing the universe. Fortunately, I'm not designing the universe, so here we are. But yeah, I white middle class guilt is, white Protestant middle class guilt is a thing.
Oh.
I'm here to tell you.
Yes, yes. No, I know. I, here's the way I would put it. And again, we're going to get pilloried so much in the comments of this conversation. Let's point that out. Which is, yes, you know, this is all about this sort of question of privilege and so forth. And, you know, as someone who is also, you know, grew up in a reasonably affluent middle class and has been able to do something where I get paid to do a lot of stuff that I really like doing anyway. The way I think about this is that there is no question that, you know, I benefited from the sort of legacy of what my parents have done and so on and so forth to get to this level. I think the only way you can deal with that is to just still work as hard as you can to make sure that, you know, the gift you've been given by your upbringing or what have you actually leads to, you know, a useful and productive life. That might sound terribly
naive.
Yeah,
and then, but, I mean, then you do get into all the Piketty questions about if our working as hard as we can also winds up ensuring that our kids are on one side of an ever-widening divide, you know, and then what are we doing, and what is our responsibility to break down that divide to make sure, you know, do we have a responsibility to see to it that others have the kinds of opportunities that our parents and grandparents took advantage of? You know, or do we not? Or, you know, what is the system being what it is? And, you know, maybe you, if you're Washington Post blog, can take down the system. But, you know, the guilt is useful insofar as it leads to a conversation and to actions, and guilt is not useful when it just leads to awkwardness. You know, that's pretty good.
That's actually not a bad way of putting it. I agree with you in the sense that, you know, the way that Hillary Clinton has handled it has just led to awkwardness. Whereas I do think this is a more, you know, you're right that, you know, there's a useful conversation to be had. I don't know, you know, we might disagree about, therefore, what you do with it, but I actually do agree with you that the conversation should be had.
Well, you know, that is probably as good as any of a place to make a transition.
Yeah.
Because I actually was in Turkey as a guest of the main opposition party, the CHP, the Republican People's Party, which, to put it mildly, is the party of the old establishment.
Right.
And, you know, the going someplace else where there's the Turkish presidential election is in August. And so to be talking about someone else's presidential politics, I'm looking at how class and money play, you know, in a system where the same people who say, we're the social democrats, you know, we're the ones who are standing up for secularism, for individual rights, for the government not crushing the little guy, are also the people who are very unabashedly the old elite is kind of a fascinating scrambling.
Mm-hmm.
And where the party that is visibly right now the party of wealth and corruption is also the party of the little guy. So it's a really fascinating moment.
It's the populist party. But can I ask a question? So let's have Turkey 101 here. It's the presidential election, and the presidency in Turkey is actually more of a ceremonial position. I mean, isn't that correct?
Yeah, this will be the first time in over a generation that the presidency has been popularly elected, which is interesting. And on the one hand, Turkey is currently and has been, you know, since the inception of the state, except for the military coup periods, a parliamentary system. Now, the interesting thing is that Erdogan, the incumbent prime minister who's expected to announce his candidacy for the presidency next week, is term limited. He can't, under the current constitution, stay on as prime minister anymore. And there is a widespread expectation that if he wins, he'll try to change to a presidential system. So, which you know,
this feels very Putin-esque, actually.
There is a lot of, you know, the sort of the debate among the opposition ranges from, you know, is Erdogan Turkey's Putin to is Erdogan Turkey's Assad? And I think, both are a little bit overblown and they miss something really important in that, Erdogan would be Turkey's Putin if Putin had been a Russian Orthodox priest who ascended to power rather than a KGB agent who was already highly familiar with all the levers of power.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what is fascinating and what's relevant about Turkey, besides its location, its economy, its being a member of NATO, but what's relevant about Turkey to the dramas that we're seeing play out elsewhere in the Middle East is that you had the rise and victory of an Islamist party through a democratic system. And it now seems clear that Erdogan personally is really in this for a lot of power in ways that go beyond democratic norms in Turkey or writ large. So then the question is kind of how does democracy in a Muslim country deal with plain old power politics wrapped in Islamism? And just the other thing I'll say that's very interesting is that you have this very secular, very elite opposition, which has chosen as its presidential candidate a non-politician who's most famous for having run the Organization of the Islamic Conference, the Organization of Muslim Countries, and who was educated at Al-Azhar in Cairo, the flagship of Islamic learning. So it's this fascinating moment of an effort to merge the secularist rule of law, European style democratic strain of Turkey's politics back into more explicit comfort with Muslim culture, and we'll see what happens with that. But you know, looking around the region, it deserves more attention and interest than maybe it's been getting.
Okay, so I have a couple questions, given that you've been in the area, and in Turkey, I have to admit, has not been on my radar. So let's see. First of all, you know, there was a lot of hope. You know, what are the sort of background arguments very often made about U.S. policy in the Middle East is the notion that Turkey was somehow going to be an exemplar for, in fact, merging, you know, an Islamic democracy, for lack of a better way of putting it, that the idea that it demonstrates you could actually have a democracy in the Middle East, and a democracy that dealt with things like Islamic-based parties. And while Turkey is not Arab, it's close enough, or you know, it's geographically close enough so that it was thought it would be an example. You know, in the last year, though, we've seen a whole variety of sort of protests in Gezi and elsewhere, suggesting that in fact, the more disturbing question is whether Turkey will be an exemplar for not so much Islamic democracy, but rather, you know, the sort of kind of quasi-democracy where, in fact, a single party holds most of the levers of power. So do you get a sense that that could potentially be a problem? Or, which is related in some ways, the cruder version of this is, does the opposition have a chance in hell of winning this presidential election?
Well, the exemplar question first, I do think that got oversold both in the West and, frankly, by Erdogan.
Absolutely.
And, you know, look, there's a big swath of the Middle East where Turkey, in the form of the Ottoman Empire, is the former colonial power. So this idea that Turkey was an exemplar always need to be taken with a grain of salt. There's a certain amount of racism going both ways, Turks toward Arabs and Arabs toward Turks. There's also the sectarian issues that arise. So, you know, that's kind of one of those things that maybe betrayed a certain amount of ignorance on the part of those pushing it. Erdogan, who's been in power since 2002, did a bunch of really good things, by the way, you know, helped move Turkey, actually got a lot of laws on the books that are a major improvement, moved along in the EU rapprochement process, opened peace talks with the PKK, the Kurdish guerrillas, and got them to lay down their arms. So, you know, in many ways, the promise was fulfilled, and in my sort of more Pollyanna-ish moments, actually, if Turkey's able to weather this period where you frankly do have, you know, just a plain old-fashioned power grab and what tends to happen when any regime finds it possible to stay in power a long time and consolidate more and more power, if Turkey's able to handle that, that by itself is going to be a much better example for the region than running around saying, hey, we're an example for the region. So,
but that's an awfully big if, but go ahead.
Yes, which brings us to your second question.
Yeah.
If I were, I mean, as a betting person, you have to bet on Erdogan to win the election, both because, you know, he starts out with a pretty good position, and then it's a two-round process, and Kurdish parties are likely to throw their votes to him in the second round because, look, the guy started a peace process and has promised a lot of things. So that's legitimate politics in a democracy, right?
Yep.
You might not like it, but it's totally legitimate. The other thing is there were local elections earlier in the spring, and some pretty serious allegations of ballot fraud. So there's reason to be concerned that between legitimate and illegitimate means, you know, Erdogan can hold on to power. I think the way to draw at least some optimism out of this is, frankly, if it's close and if the opposition parties come away sort of with a new public appreciation of who they are and how willing they are to be relevant to Turkish society as a whole, and if the international community comes away, and this is at least as big an if, frankly, because with every other crisis you've got going on, you're not going to spend a lot of time pushing on someone who doesn't look like he's going anywhere.
Yeah.
But if Erdogan no longer has a free pass from the international community, and you have sort of continuing growth of opposition forces inside the country, that should make it harder for him to continue on a totally Putin-esque consolidation of power path and keep Turkey in, how can I put this? You know, again, I don't want to pretend that Turkey's going to look like Britain. But keep Turkey on an evolving path rather than a path clearly away from rule of law and democracy. So that would be my modulated optimism.
Well, I want to share your modulated optimism, although the darker scenario I would paint is, even in the scenario where you're talking about where it's actually close, is that if it's close and there's allegations of corruption, what winds up happening if people wind up taking to the streets? If instead the opposition, you know, responds not by deciding, okay, we got hosed on this, but we're just going to redouble our efforts in terms of democracy. Instead, you see what happens in, let's say, Venezuela or Ukraine last year, where you start seeing people go out onto the streets, which is not necessarily, you know, then it depends on how the regime handles it. But based on how Erdogan handled the Gezi protests, I'm less optimistic than you are about how that would play out.
Well, this lets us transition, make a sort of an interesting comparative point. And there's an academic, a Turkish academic writing on this at Princeton, and you can check her out on Twitter at Zeynep, Zeynep.
She is actually at UNC Chapel Hill now.
That's funny. I talked to her last week about Princeton, but okay.
This is Zeynep Tufekci, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I think she's now at UNC. She was at Princeton, but, or maybe I'm wrong. Go ahead. Anyway.
Hey, you know, jet lag.
Yeah.
But anyway, but she's looking comparatively at, social movement protests.
Yeah.
Gezi in Turkey, Egypt, Iran. And, you know, the point that I think is relevant here is that the people who are out in the streets for those are not by and large the same people that are sort of contesting politics. And this, it's interesting. It's very true in Turkey. And we had, you know, really interesting, honest conversations about, you know, sort of how many of the folks who were out demonstrating and got tear gassed and beaten by the police were you able to recruit to the opposition party?
Right.
You know, what is the role of party politics? And she makes the point that she said, you know, when I heard the same rhetoric at Occupy as that I heard in Egypt, I thought, oh, that's weird. And she said, but then when I heard it in my own country, Turkey, she said, I knew something bigger was going on. So, you know, in some ways, the scenario you posit where angry young liberals, small L or large L, whichever it is, come into the streets, you know, in a way, that is going to be the next step of what you're going to see in all these places. And so, again, you know, to the extent that Turkey, you know, frankly, has better institutions in place than Egypt or Ukraine, or certainly Iran, and, you know, has some ability to deal with it is, you know, sort of good example, bad example. It's kind of the best example we got. So that's all reasons to pay attention, I guess. But you asked me in an email when we were getting ready for this whether ISIS and the problems in the region were more or less important than China. And I that seemed like a provocative question that I want to hear your answer to.
So I just blogged about this today on the at the Washington Post, and it was struck by this notion that, you know, we tend to pay attention to where there are like sort of acute crises. So without question, you know, attention, I would argue, for the last month has been paid to, you know, since Iraq split apart, attention has obviously been played there, you know, paid there. The fact that you have, should I say ISIS or ISIL? I don't know which, you know.
I don't understand that either.
Yeah. So I'm going to say,
I think it's a question of which language we're,
fair enough,
we're working in.
Okay. I'm going to say ISIS because it recalls for me the late 70s television show, that was a spinoff of Shazam, which is a whole another thing we can go to later. But, you know, there is a genuine legitimate concern to be had if ISIS suddenly has a base of operations in which it can potentially decide to make mischief. And the question is, will it therefore decide to make mischief towards the United States? And I have to admit, a lot of Middle East people, you know, Middle East experts like to focus on this, but Frank Fukuyama had an interesting op-ed in the Financial Times a couple days ago where he said, look, this is nuts that, you know, there's this concern in the Obama administration, you know, in the West Point speech, prioritized terrorism among everything, you know, over everything else in terms of national security threats. But if you really want to step back for a little bit, the real concern is the notion that you've got great powers like Russia and China mucking around with things like sovereign borders. You know, that you have Russia deciding we're going to annex the Crimea and there's nothing anyone can do about it. And China seems to be trying to do something similar with respect to the South China Sea and East China Sea. And, you know, if you want to argue there is a core to the international system, it's this notion of you don't mess around, you know, messing around with borders is a pretty big friggin' deal. And that's not happened. That while states can potentially break apart or, you know, secede, like in the case of Eritrea or South Sudan or even Czechoslovakia, and this might eventually happen with respect to Iraq, it's another thing entirely for a great power to gobble up other parts of territory. And I have to say, I do find this a compelling argument. In the sense of this is for me a bigger concern than what's going on in the Middle East, and that perhaps we've exaggerated that Obama has committed the same error as George W. Bush has in terms of exaggerating the threats posed by terrorism.
Well, hang on, because there's a couple of different. I think we're talking different threats here. If we think that the fundamental threat to the international system today is states breaking apart. Then it seems to me that what great powers are doing and what ISIS is doing are two different attacks on the same fundamental pillar of the system in that, you know, we can't really figure out how to, or we, and I would actually, sorry, my jet lag mind is not moving very quickly here, but if the problem is the threat of states breaking up rather than who's doing it, then, I mean, I would almost argue the reverse, that we have more system in place to limit what Russia or China is willing to do vis-a-vis attacking the international system than we do to limit what an actor like ISIS is willing to do. We basically have no limits on what ISIS, because we don't have a way of containing them, really, other than fighting them. So if the fundamental problem is the breakup of the state-based foundation of the international system, then I don't see how you class ISIS as a lesser threat. It's a different threat. Now, I think you could also make the argument that the threat to the state-based foundation of the international system is only one of the challenges that we're facing, and there are others, some of which emanate from great powers and not from not from non-state actors.
Right.
So I think I'm unsympathetic to the argument that per se, because they're great powers, they're a bigger threat. I'm certainly sympathetic to the frustration that anything that happens in the Middle East gets more attention and ink than anything that happens anywhere else. And anything that happens involving weaponry and sort of, the convenient fact that the Chinese aren't massacring civilians and the Russians are massacring relatively few civilians has, kept it out of the news. But I do think it's excessively old think focused to say the same threat is more important if it comes from a great power than if it comes from a non-state actor.
Ooh, I'm going to push back on this. So, I mean, in some ways, first of all, I think we are in agreement on one thing, which is the frustrating thing about the foreign policy debate is the way in which it is crisis-driven rather than, potentially taking a step back and sort of actually trying to figure out what is the bigger systemic threat. So, as you say, the problem is the Middle East has hogged a lot of the attention, even though, again, it's not like, tensions in the East China Sea or South China Sea are going away, or for that matter, that Russia is going to suddenly, volunteer to give the Crimea back to Ukraine. I'm not sure I buy the argument, though, that all of these things are part of the same threat, which is the sort of breakup of the state system. And that's not what I'm so much arguing. I think there's a question of what is the bigger threat? The weakness of the state in particular regions, namely the Middle East, or the strength of the state in the case of great powers, in the case of Russia and China. And here, I guess, it's worth thinking more specifically, which is what can ISIS do with the area that it holds? And here, I guess, I tend to think that the last time they were in charge, they managed to pretty much alienate, the people that they were governing, for lack of a better way of putting it. And I'm going to use air quotes liberally on that. It kind of led to the Anbar Awakening and so on and so forth. I see no evidence to suggest that that's not going to replay itself again. I think it's a concern, but it's a limited one. And I think there's only so much that violent non-state actors can do to harm U.S. interests, although they can certainly do a lot to harm regional interests. Whereas on the other hand, in terms of threats that actually affect U.S. security, it's a little old school, but I actually do think China matters more here than what's going on in the Middle East. Again, which is not to say the Middle East is not unimportant, but in some ways part of the issue, and you and I both know that the administration right now is trying to write a national security strategy. Part of this is the prioritization of what you think is important. And here, I'm not sure I agree with the argument that terrorism is more important than a rising China.
Well, I actually wouldn't argue that terrorism is more important than a rising China, because terrorism is a tactic. So the question is, are there threats to elements of the international system that are fundamental to U.S. well-being, where terrorism is being used to further those threats? And then that's the problem,
right?
Not the fact that it's being done with terrorism or that it's being done by ISIS.
You're clearly getting over your jet lag. I agree with that completely.
Damn, I can't use that as an excuse
exactly.
anymore. But the second sort of point or question I would have is, I push back on the idea that what gets column inches in the media is equal to what's most important. Now, I would reluctantly agree with you that if measured by sort of where think tank dollars and brilliant minds' time is spent, a little too much is on the Middle East, and a little too little is on Asia, and a lot too little is on Africa and Latin America, by the way, just while we're sort of wandering around the globe.
Let's throw climate change into the mix, too, while we're at it, but go ahead.
Oh, that.
Yeah.
I'm wary of saying it doesn't get attention, therefore it's not. And, Russia, I was at a meeting this morning where someone made the great point. In a way, right now, we want to be doing a lot on Ukraine and not talking very much.
Yes.
That we want it not to be getting a lot of public attention, and we want to give Putin an avenue to back down quietly.
Yeah.
So, again, just the fact that something's not on the front page of the paper does, or that, there are only 3 think tank meetings about it this week rather than 30, isn't necessarily a gauge of anything.
But, all right. Let me ask you, and this is where you as a more of an insider than me can potentially lay my fears, which is the impression I get when I talk to, administration officials or low-level staffers, is that in fact the problem is that the White House does care very much so about what is absorbing sort of pundit attention on this stuff. And because it's therefore absorbed in the Middle East, you wind up with, and you and I both know that the sort of scarcest resource for policy, foreign policy principles is time. How much time are they devoting to area A as opposed to area B? And my concern is that precisely because the Middle East seems to be more of a political problem, it winds up forcing, the leadership to devote more man hours to that than to these underlying serious problems as well.
Well, let me tell you my theory of governance, which is that the right way to run as big a country as this with as many interests as it has is to put the best people you possibly can in senior and mid-level positions, let them know sort of generally what your outlook and principles for the world are, and then let them go. So that ideally, your China policy is always being run by the best possible people who could be running it. And, I don't want to, I can't totally disagree with you. High level attention matters, but I think it's quite possible to, if the only measure of whether something was being handled properly was how much time the president is spending on it, it wouldn't be a very good measure. So, I don't entirely disagree with you, but I also think actually one of the things that maybe this NSC has not done as well as it might have is exactly that kind of delegating.
Yeah.
And so sometimes we don't want, as the world gets bigger and bigger and more complex, we have to actually get further away from the idea that, a president can personally be doing everything because he or she just can't. So, I acknowledge the validity of your point about time and Washington can only do one crisis at a time and so on and so on, but it's, let's not overstate.
Let me put it this way. On the one hand, I take your point. On the other hand, part of the issue here, though, is that, in fact, the Obama administration has absolutely zero bench when it comes to Pacific Rim foreign policy. That a lot of the people who were there during the first term that were the architects of the pivot or the rebalancing or what have you are now no longer the administration. And I don't know who has replaced them. So Kirk Campbell isn't there. Jim Steinberg isn't there. Tom Donilon isn't there. Hillary Clinton isn't there. So part of the issue is that the very people you would want them to, to lean on for this sort of thing, it's not obvious to me that those people are up to par.
Well, I could name off the people who have replaced them, and I think they're all very smart and capable, but that's sort of not really the point. I do actually have a bigger theory about the thin bench on Asia,
yeah,
which is a perennial problem. And what I've been wondering is, there are lots of young people who are going and studying and teaching in China and learning Chinese and traveling the region. And are those folks mostly going into the private sector and not into public policy / academia / government? Is that why we're, because I, in my own hiring experience, I could have hired 5 young Middle Easternists for every young Asianist, yet I see the numbers about Americans studying in Asia. So is it just that those folks see the dynamism as on the private sector side, or where do they go?
I think that's actually a pretty decent – I have no evidence to back this up of my – I would – probably say your hypothesis is correct. You know, I've been to enough, like, occasionally, you know, as part of the Bobo thing, I occasionally get to go to, like, you know, consultant conferences or what have you. And, you know, in those things, it's almost a requirement that if you're giving a talk about the future of the global economy, you have to utter the sentence, you know, I was in Nanjing last week, and this is what I saw there. You know, you have to, or insert random Chinese city there, or random Pacific Rim city. So I suspect that there is a bigger private sector market for those people, perhaps, than for the Middle East types.
I mean, I'm just thinking about, you know, on the Russia, Eastern Europe side, yeah. There's a whole coterie of people who went into the private sector and then came out again. And I'm thinking of a number of policymakers and senior folks who spent some time as young people in the private sector in that part of the world and then decided they didn't care for it and came back to the policy side. And I don't know whether it'll be interesting to see whether that happens on the China.
Well, that's true. Although the other thing is that on the academic side, I mean, one of the things that happened, I remember there was a New York Times story about this, I think a couple months ago, pointing out that in fact, at least in the academy, there is almost no bench whatsoever when it comes to Russia and Eastern Europe. Because in some ways that was an area of the world that kind of fell out of fashion, with the end of the Cold War and particularly with Russia's, weakness over the last generation. So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, all of my peers, you know, who did, you know, when I did an undergrad degree in Russian and those folks, you know, who went on and went into PhD programs, it was a brutal job market.
Right, exactly.
It's the faddishness. I mean, you know, this actually goes back to in
right.
a funny way. Your point about, you know, what the media covers versus what's important.
Exactly.
Because it, there's no question that it affected what fields people were steered into and what fields got funded.
Yeah. And I think that's continuing to be the case, which is, so in some ways, it's not just a question of who goes into government. It's also literally, if you're interested in international relations and you're trying to pick out what niche are you going to specialize in, you know, whether you go the academic route or you go the public policy route or what have you, in some ways you're talking about a couple of years of investment at a minimum to do this. And I think there's a tendency sometimes for people to look out there and think, well, what's hot now? And so as a result, you wind up with a glut in some areas and a dearth in others.
Well, look, I mean, as someone who went into Russia in the late 80s because it was absolutely fascinating, I mean, that is what people do and there's no reason for them not to do it. Yeah, I mean.
This way, I think you want to study a place you find interesting. You don't want to study a place because you think other people think that will be important. That's my point.
Fair enough.
Okay.
Well, okay. Speaking of which, what if you were choosing the part of the world to focus on based on the World Cup results? What would you do?
You'd actually, for once, focus on North America. Because North America or CONCACAF, which has been the weak sister of the various international soccer federations, has had a very good World Cup so far. Only four teams from the North American region qualified, but three of them have moved on past the group round: the United States, Costa Rica, and Mexico. I do fear, though, that this is almost like if you ever follow the NCAA basketball tournament, inevitably there's a couple Cinderella teams that make it to the Sweet 16, and then those teams are pretty much summarily dismissed at that point by whatever massive favorite they play, and then, you know, the conversation stops. So I'm worried about whether or not any of these teams will advance beyond, you know, their next game. Beyond that, I'm sort of curious. How long were you in Turkey?
A week.
Oh, okay. So you missed... You missed much of the World Cup fever or the debate about the extent to which there has been World Cup fever in the United States. But it did seem like the crowds were pretty big in DuPont Circle.
Yeah, you mentioned Ann Coulter, and I did hear him this morning while I was trying to follow up on him, while I was trying to learn what I had missed on important world events. I learned that. And I think I qualify under this, that it's if all your great-grandparents, nobody who all of their great-grandparents
right.
were born here. Like, I mean, all I can say is, you know, Ann Coulter clearly did not date abroad while she was in college. Because there is a perfectly legitimate American way to get interested in football. And I'm surprised, given Ms. Coulter's frequent reliance on her feminine charms, that she doesn't seem to have picked that one up.
Yeah, I would say on the Ann Coulter thing, you know, I would actually highly recommend. Alyssa Rosenberg wrote a pretty good piece in the Washington Post on the skill with the culture piece is a demonstration of the very, very skillful way some people on the right wing are just expert on trolling. That the right trolls far better than the left does, in the sense of that it's, you know, the culture piece is one of these sort of tired, hackneyed things that nevertheless gets a lot of people very, very exercised about it. And then, you know, their defense is often, well, come on, you know, it's not that serious and so forth. But in some ways, again, it occupies attention and outrage and so forth. And, you know, places like the Free Beacon and others do that relatively well. The thing that I was shocked by was just literally how factually wrong Coulter's piece was. You know, things like complaining about the length of soccer. Soccer has a lot of problems, but, you know, as someone who's a baseball fan, telling me that soccer is too long is not really going to fly. You know, that there's a lot of problems I have occasionally with the sport, and I blog about this also, which is the thing that bothers me most about soccer is that there's not always a correlation between the team that plays better on the field and them actually winning.
But that's not unique to soccer.
It's not unique to soccer, but I would say, and absolutely.
It's a feature of international politics, too, we might
say. Oh, that's a fair point. It's a feature of all sports. I think it happens more often in soccer than it does in other sports. You know, in baseball or in football, absolutely there are times where the team that played better that day doesn't necessarily win. I think it happens more frequently in soccer, and this might be the fact that it's because it's a low-scoring game and because ties are more are a more common outcome. But, like, you know, if you take the U.S.-Portugal, for example, game, which I don't know if you were able to watch, the U.S. actually outplayed Portugal. It might have been the best I've ever seen the U.S. team play in the years that I've watched them play in World Cup. And yet, you know, they in the end it winds up being a tie. It was just an incredibly frustrating game.
So, okay, let's get down to the real thing here.
Yeah.
We got to put it on the line here.
Oh, God.
So Belgium is also something of a Cinderella team that wasn't necessarily expected to make it this far. So which Cinderella goes to the ball and which one gets sent back home with the stepsisters?
Every rational part of my brain says that Belgium will beat the United States, because Belgium has not, they've won three games, but they haven't won convincingly. But you can argue that might be because Belgium has actually underperformed so far. So if Belgium actually gets their A game together, they potentially could crush the United States, particularly the United States without Jozy Altidor. But that said, I will be the optimist on this and actually suggest that the United States upsets the land of Moolfleet, because if for no other reason, one of the few advantages I think the United States has, and this has actually been pleasant to see watching the games, is they actually do have something of a home field advantage. I've been surprised at the extent to which the crowds have actually really been far more, you know, in favor of the United States than the team that the United States is playing.
Well, interestingly, as Belgium's football team has had this unexpected success, Belgian politics have sort of seen a collapse where the party that won the most recent elections is unable to form a government. So I'm gonna get a little snarky here, and I am gonna point out that underperforming is a bit of a Belgian national tradition.
So in a
burst of totally uncalled for optimism, I'm going with Team USA as well. So here's my last geopolitical question for you. What is it that has finally let the CONCACAF come into its own this time around? We usually spend most of these dialogues talking about what the U.S. is doing wrong around the world. What are we and our Central American neighbors doing right?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Okay, I'm going to tie this to a policy point, which is to say the thing that North America does better is being open to immigration. Or open to foreign influence, which is, you know, part of the reason the U.S. team has performed relatively well is the existence of five German Americans, on the team. And indeed and I'm sorry, his name is escaping me, but I think Jacques, I can't remember his last name, but the players had really the best World Cup from the U.S. side, was one of those players, not to mention the fact that our coach is German as well.
German coach.
Yeah, exactly. I do think also, though, that in some ways, the fact that the games are in the Western Hemisphere might actually have something to do with it, which is, you know, you actually have Mexicans and Americans and Costa Ricans in the crowd rooting the team on. And the home field thing does seem to count for something in World Cup sports. I think that that was a factor in Nate Silver's calculations, although obviously it benefits Brazil far more than it benefits the United States and others. So so that I'll leave it at that.
Well, does Nate's sort of home field – there's also a home field disadvantage, which I think Brazil is struggling with a little bit in the same way as you see French players at the French Open and British players at the British Open. There is this intense pressure when you're the home team, and so I would posit, and when we develop our model and sell it to Nate, you would actually this suggests that maybe there's a small plus for being close but not in your own country.
That's an interesting argument. You're right. So, but that does suggest, if your logic is correct, then Argentina should win the World Cup. You know, not Uruguay, because I believe the Suarez was has been banned because of his zombie-like traits on the pitch. Did you?
I was waiting for you to get zombie in here somewhere.
Zombie-like traits on the pitch. Argentina, on the other hand, you know, is a relatively strong side, and it's obviously from a neighboring country. So by that logic, you and I have developed a new model that says Argentina will win the World Cup.
I would have a hard time arguing with you on that, although my heart is with the Dutch.
Oh, but really? Okay.
Those games were beautiful.
Actually, one of the things I wanted to do if I had my graphics capabilities would be a flow chart for the, you know, for Americans of who should you root for in the World Cup if the U.S. loses. You know, so, you know, was this, you know, did we fight a war with this country? Is this country an ally of ours? You know, do you have ethnic, you know, roots in that country and so on and so forth? So,
a version of that exists on Facebook, which was sort of like, do you want to root for a team that has an actual chance of winning the World Cup?
Ooh.
Do you need to root for a team that's a democracy?
There we
funny,
go.
Although, but I think, you know, it had the disadvantage of having been done at the beginning of the whole thing. So you're definitely in position to make one, you know, say for the next round.
It's going to be a race between me and BuzzFeed. Okay.
Well, you can make your column, right? The BuzzFeed competitor.
There we go.
All right. Well, on that note, yeah. Now that we've set Dan up to compete with BuzzFeed, we will see you all again next month, at which time we will have to eat copious amounts of crow for having predicted that the U.S. would make it another stage and that Argentina would win the whole thing.
Yes. All right. Till next time, Heather.
Great. Bye-bye.